Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. It's too easy for too many of us to forget how much blood and treasure this nation continues to spend on the war in Afghanistan. After 16 years, American generals admit it's a stalemate. The Taliban pushes suicide missions into the heart of the capital and boasts, "You can't beat us." The president, who wanted to get out, is sending more troops and says, "No end date, no negotiating." This hour on Point, what's the point of America's longest war and is it winnable? You can join us on air or online. Do you know why we're in Afghanistan? What do you think mission accomplished would look like? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Just about 10 days ago, insurgents stormed the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, the Afghan capital, where they hunted down foreigners. At least 22 were killed, including several Americans. Here's CBS's David Martin reporting.
It's not the first time Americans have been killed in a terrorist attack in Kabul, but it brought home just how unsafe the Afghan capital is after 16 years of war. A suicide squad of six Taliban fighters terrorized the Intercontinental Hotel for 14 hours over the weekend before the last of them was killed.
CBS's David Martin reporting there. And joining me first from Kabul is Pamela Constable. She's Pakistan and Afghanistan bureau chief for The Washington Post. She's been reporting from the region since 1998 and has lived on and off in the Afghan capital since the war began. Pamela Constable, very good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
You know, we heard that report from David Martin talking about how just that one particular attack driving home the point about just how dangerous the capital is now. I'd like to hear your description of conditions on the ground.
I would say they are extremely tense. People are very nervous. There are men in uniforms with guns throughout the capital in many major streets and intersections. It doesn't quite feel like Iraq, but it certainly feels closer to Baghdad than it ever has before. People are very much on edge, and the government is really scrambling to try and reassure the populace that that things are under control, but everyone knows that they are not.
And Pam, as someone who's gone in and out of Kabul for many years, who's lived there, talk a little bit about how you've seen it change, because at one point it wasn't like it is today, right?
You know, it's been such a roller coaster. I mean, under the Taliban, it was incredibly safe. You could go anywhere. You could, you know, they really controlled things very tightly. They were there in response to a civil war, and they really cracked down. I mean, there was no crime. It was a safe and quiet city. Of course, it was completely deserted, and there was no one there, and nothing was going on, and it was isolated from the world. When the Taliban fell, after, you know, a short time, a semblance of democracy was introduced with a huge amount of international support. The society opened up. Beauty parlors were established. People cut their beards short. Schools opened. There was this amazing breath of fresh air, which lasted for a good 5 or 6 years while the Taliban regrouped and attention turned to Iraq. And so then after that, 2006, 7, 8, 9, you began to see really strong Taliban insurgency coming back, and you began to see a war coming again that has really plagued the country ever since. And it's very, very, very sad to see and sad to feel, because there was so much hope here. There was such an excitement and buildup and international presence, a real hope for the future that really does seem to have dissipated greatly.
Three big attacks in recent days on the military academy, the Intercontinental Hotel, an ambulance packed with explosives in central Kabul. Those last two, they're soft civilian targets. What does that tell us about the strength of the insurgency right now? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And there was another one as well in the city of Jalalabad, which was an attack on Save the Children, one of the most enduring and beloved charities here. It's a British-run charity that's been here through thick and thin for decades. And to have selected them as a target is also quite revealing. I mean, there are those who say that they're selecting soft targets because they can't win on the battlefield. But that's a very, you know, dubious assertion because they're still being very aggressive out in rural provinces, including some new ones that they haven't been in before. So I think this is really, you know, an act of defiance. This is basically saying, you know, we don't want to talk. You know, we're on a roll. We can attack anywhere, anytime, whether it's the middle of nowhere or the middle of the capital. And that's a very frightening message.
Yeah. Now, you know, I'm reading reports that even members of the U.S. military can't move around the capital at their will, right? They have to fly around in helicopters because it's just not safe.
Well, I mean, that's right. And, I mean, they don't move around very much at will. There are convoys of Humvees and these big MRAPs, these giant monstrous, I don't know what, Martian-type vehicles that do move around in convoys around the city. They do move around in these very highly protected convoys, but they do in fact use helicopters now to transport soldiers and officials even 5 minutes from bases and offices to the airport, because there have been so many attacks on the international airport here as well as on official convoys, both Afghan and international. So I guess they've just decided it's not worth the risk. But to have those helicopters flying over all the time, they make a lot of noise too. You can't talk when they're flying over downtown Kabul. It's a constant reminder of the threat and the fear that people feel here.
At the State of the Union address, Pam, I want to hear a little bit of tape from Donald Trump from his State of the Union address 2 nights ago. He devoted all of 2 sentences to the war in Afghanistan, and what he talked about were new rules of engagement. Here's a little bit of what he said.
As of a few months ago, our warriors in Afghanistan have new rules of engagement. Along with their heroic Afghan partners, our military is no longer undermined by artificial timelines, and we no longer tell our enemies our plans.
So, Pam, when people in Afghanistan, and the people that I'm talking about are people who are trying to live normal lives in the capital, maybe folks who are trying to run Western aid agencies to the extent that those still exist, what do they think? What are they thinking when they're hearing the president these days?
Well, it is true that there are a lot fewer foreigners here. There are a lot fewer aid agencies operating, certainly with foreigners. Certainly they still exist, but there are a lot few Westerners here working in them. And people don't go out. I mean, people don't go out at night. They don't go to restaurants. Mm-hmm. Everybody's very much locked down in their compounds. You don't see Westerners walking on the streets at all. I mean, I can remember 10 years ago, you would see hundreds of them and people would go out to dinner and they'd walk around. That's not the case anymore. I think what foreigners there are here now are feeling is sadness, worry, frustration, concern that all the gains that have been made here, all the enormous amount, the billions of dollars that have been spent by not only the United States, but the European Union, the United Nations, other parts of the world. I mean, huge amounts of effort has gone into rebuilding this society. And I think there's this creeping fear that, not that it's all been in vain, because there's still going to be people living here and working here and trying to survive and make ends meet, but that the idea of truly rebuilding or building a poor, war-devastated country into some sort of a modern, more modern semblance of a functioning democracy has turned out to be a much dicier and more difficult proposition than anyone ever thought it would be.
Now, sticking with the Trump administration's policy for a moment, the president's going to be sending, the U.S. is going to be sending another 5,000 troops or so, bringing the total up to about 14,000. Not exactly a surge, maybe a mini surge. In your view, can this make a difference for the better?
It certainly can't hurt. It has been launched with very specific and limited goals. For example, lots of training of Afghan Special Operation Forces, lots of training of Afghan Air Force, lots of intensive training of combat units at a more granular level than was allowed or practiced before. This is not, as you say, a giant surge. They're not even calling it a mini surge. They're calling it sort of the reinforcement of what they'd already been doing, which is an agreement they've got with the Afghan government that over the next 5 years, they will do all they can to help the Afghan Defense Forces be able to defend the country on their own. So I think it's a very reasonable sounding proposition. The problem is that you've got a very, very aggressive and resilient insurgency, not only the Taliban, but you've got the Islamic State, a local version of that in there too. So I don't know what numbers you can put on it to make a difference. Mm. The critics will say it's just more of the same, even though it's not with deadlines and it's not with timelines. It's still just basically doing a little bit more of what we've done in the past, and that is true. And whether that can turn the war around, I don't think so.
Oh, boy. Well, Pamela Constable is Pakistan and Afghanistan bureau chief for The Washington Post. She's been speaking to us from Kabul. Pam, we really appreciate having you today. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. After over a week of brazen, deadly, bloody attacks right under the noses of U.S., Afghan, and government forces in Kabul, we're taking stock of America's longest-running war. Listeners, when you hear reporters like Pam Constable saying that the Afghan capital feels more like Iraq after 16 years of fighting there, what do you think? Did you hope President Trump would rip off that Band-Aid and just get out as he promised? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Saturday, insurgents detonated an explosives-filled ambulance at lunchtime in downtown Kabul, killing over 100 people, wounding more than 200 others. 2 days later, President Trump rejected any talk of negotiating with the Taliban.
There's no talking to the Taliban. We don't want to talk to the Taliban. We're going to finish what we have to finish. What nobody else has been able to finish, we're going to be able to do it.
All right. Well, joining me now is Johnny Walsh. He's a senior expert on Afghanistan at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He's worked on Afghanistan and Pakistan issues for over 10 years for the State Department, most recently as a lead advisor on the Afghan peace process. He was last in Afghanistan in November. He joins me today from Washington, D.C. And Johnny Walsh, thank you for coming on the show. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you.
And from member station KAZU in Monterey, California, Thomas Johnson joins us. He's professor of the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval Postgraduate School and director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies there. He's been studying and traveling to Afghanistan since 1976. His latest book, which just came out yesterday, is called Taliban Narratives, The Use and Power of Stories in the Afghanistan Conflict. And Tom, it's great to have you as well. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Anthony. It's my distinct pleasure.
So, Tom, let me start with you, if I could. The first question, after 16 years of American involvement in the war in Afghanistan, we're hearing the word stalemate an awful lot. Is this a stalemate?
Well, first of all, General Nicholson likes to call it a stalemate. Anybody that's studied insurgencies will recognize that a stalemate is actually a victory for the insurgent. So every time General Nicholson suggests that Afghanistan is a stalemate, he's basically saying the Taliban have won. I don't think it's a stalemate. I think the Taliban are actually in control of the situation. And to get
you think
to the
they've
question,
already won. You think they've already?
I think that they've already won. My book is, if you take a look at post-World War intra-state conflicts, be they civil wars, be they insurgencies, be they wars of national liberation, these have basically been wars of narratives. And this is what my book is all about. And if you even take a look at the field manual for the United States Army considering counterinsurgency, it'll suggest that 80% of the battle is informational and only 20% is military actions or military kinetics. And I think that, Steve Cole, who wrote the brilliant Ghost Wars and has a great new book coming out called Directorate Z shortly, had a brilliant New York Times op-ed piece last Sunday and said the reason that we're not doing well in Afghanistan is we don't really know why we're there.
I read that piece,
And I agree with that completely. And we've lost the war of the story in Afghanistan, and we can't recover.
All right. Well, I want to talk more about what that story is or should be. But let me come over to you, Johnny Walsh, and respond to what Tom just said. I mean, do you think this war is already lost on the ground? We've been hearing stalemate, but Tom says, no, the Taliban's already won it.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to say that the war's already lost. I would certainly say that the Taliban are quite strong. They grow a bit stronger each year. That's true in most regions of the country, in particular in the countryside. And in urban areas, we saw over the last week the group's ability to project violence into what are supposed to be even the most secure areas of the country. At the same time, the Taliban have a problem that they can't defeat the U.S. or the Afghan security forces any more than those security forces can defeat the Taliban. So I think the stalemate term is thrown around for good reason. It is absolutely true that time is ultimately on their side if, for example, U.S. forces were to withdraw. But what we're looking at under current circumstances is a long, grinding war.
Are you saying we're looking at the need for a long – in other words, does it make sense for the U.S. to grind on if the situation on the ground is a stalemate?
As a matter of policy, the entire problem in Afghanistan is there really aren't great options. But if you look at what could be done, the status quo essentially is a long stalemate. We have increased our troop numbers. I'd say very few observers would say that the increase is enough to strategically win the war or to defeat the Taliban. That's a military reality. If we wanted to go for a true victory, a few years ago we learned that even 140,000 NATO troops really were not nearly enough to achieve that comprehensive defeat of the insurgency. And that's what leads you to the other option of seeking a negotiated settlement, a peace process for the country.
Well, I want to get to sort of the big question about what's the solution. But Tom Johnson, let me come back to you and this sort of provocative idea that you brought up from Steve Call, who wrote this weekend that we can't win in Afghanistan because we don't know why we're there. You talk about a sort of lack of narrative. Is that to suggest that obviously the Taliban and the rest of the insurgency there, they have a pretty good narrative that we lack? Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Afghanistan is a very multi-layered society and culture. And we went into Afghanistan not understanding the basics of the rural area. And you've got to understand that this is very different from Iraq in that Iraq was basically an urban insurgency. This is a rural insurgency. 75% of Afghans live in rural areas. And the Taliban have narratives and associated stories that push their cause, and that it's primarily focused on the rural areas, which is, from my perspective, has always been the center of gravity. But, you know, I really think, let me give you a story. Back in 2009, I was invited to a major conference in Washington to give a keynote address to all of the principals and deputies that were involved in U.S. information operations and psychological operations in Afghanistan. And after speaking for about an hour or something, I asked the crowd if I could ask them a question. And I asked them, what are the three things to the Afghan people this year?
Tom, I'm going to ask you to back up just a second because we lost your line. We didn't get the question that you asked the folks.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, after my speech, I asked the folks in the room, and these are principals and deputies of all the people involved in American information operations and psychological operations. I asked them, what are the three themes that we're going to be pushing this year to try to convince the Afghans that, you know, we're not occupiers, that our presence in the country is good? And the room went blank. I knew at that time, at least intuitively, my intuition told me that the war was over, that we had lost, although I had been writing that we were making massive mistakes in publishing on this since 2006. I don't think 15,000 troops can do what actually NATO had 150,000 troops for a number of years can do. And I'm very pessimistic on the future. I mean, just consider that we've spent between $850 billion and $1 trillion in Afghanistan. Now, most of that's relative to our military. And as you so rightfully discussed with Pamela, Americans can't even drive in Kabul, the central city. I mean, the International Red Cross is pulled out. I mean, last November, the New York Times said that both Kabul and the Pentagon were classifying casualty rates for the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces. A couple of days ago, the special investigator for Afghan reconstruction produced and reported their quarterly report to Congress. And in that report, they couldn't even suggest the number of districts that were under Taliban control or leaning because they said that it had been classified. Now, the Pentagon later came back and said that was a labeling mistake, and they released that information. But these are clear indicators that this is a terrible situation, and the Taliban know it, and they know that time is on their side.
Johnny Walsh, I want to come back to you to this sort of fundamental question, I guess, that Tom raised, that Steve Call raised in that New York Times piece, why are we in Afghanistan? Doesn't the answer go back to post 9/11, which was the original reason President George W. Bush went to war in Afghanistan, and that was to chase Al-Qaeda out? And I guess the rationale for staying would be to not let Afghanistan become a place where terror groups could reform, find haven, and plot again against the U.S. Is that the reason that we stay?
That is the reason in a nutshell. We went into Afghanistan shortly after 9/11 in response to those attacks, which were planned and launched by a group based on Afghan soil. The Taliban are quick to point out that we attacked the Taliban for something they themselves did not do, in that it was Al-Qaeda. That wasn't a very persuasive argument at the time. And we have stayed in Afghanistan because we have not succeeded in stabilizing the country during that time. I think when this administration took a fresh look at the reasons for staying, and with the president having said the things he said about the impulse to get out, it was hard not to see a high risk of a significant terrorist threat returning to Afghan soil in the total absence of U.S. troops. And that doesn't present great options, but it is true that the Afghanistan-Pakistan border regions are some of the most fertile ground for extremist groups in the world. And to entirely cede that territory without having any tools in the region to combat it creates security risks that could bring us right back into Afghanistan in the future at much greater cost. And I think that is what has driven three successive administrations now to remain there.
Well, let's listen to the president of the current administration. Here's Donald Trump speaking recently. I mean, his message as a candidate was, let's get out of Afghanistan. As president, he has backpedaled. Last August, he delivered a primetime address on Afghanistan from Fort Myer Military Base, explaining why he changed his mind.
My original instinct was to pull out. And historically, I like following my instincts. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you're president of the United States.
That's Donald Trump speaking last August. Tom Johnson, and getting back to this idea of why we are still there, respond to this idea that perhaps it's necessary because of the very issues that Johnny Walsh was just talking about, that if we don't stay there, we create instability and we'll be sucked back in there eventually.
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that the vast majority of the terrorist organizations, while there are some that are in Afghanistan, the vast majority are in Pakistan. And you will never – there's never been an instance of an international terrorist event being conducted by an Afghan. Or the Taliban. When I get on a plane in San Francisco to go back east or to go to Afghanistan, I'm surely not worried about an attack on that plane by the Taliban because we've never seen the Taliban perform any terrorist acts outside of Afghanistan. So, you know, Johnny makes a good point. But let's remember that the Taliban also had While 9/11 was hatched and planned in Afghanistan by al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, the Taliban did not know anything what was going on. They were not part of the planning process. And you've got to recognize that when we initially went into the country, we went to clear out al-Qaeda. Now, we said that we, you know, President Bush policy was also people that harbored were also going to be viewed as terrorists and go after them. But it's important to recognize that the Taliban have not performed international acts of terror. Now, that's not to suggest if we left that terrorists couldn't come back into the country. But I think there are other considerations more important.
Let's take a couple of callers. Hope is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hope, you're on the air. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Good to be here.
Tell me what's on your mind.
So I spent a year in Afghanistan working for an engineering company that was an implementing partner of USAID. And while there, I really came to believe that in the short term, our military presence is absolutely key to providing what limited security we are able to provide at this point. And even more so that long term, our long term military intervention does not address the structural causes of Taliban recruitment, of civilian support for the Taliban. And so what I'm thinking about when I'm hearing this conversation is you know, the real human cost of war and what human cost we risk by withdrawing our forces and the commitment that we made to the Afghan people.
Hope, thanks so much for your call, and I really appreciate it. Tom and Johnny, I'd like you both to respond to Hope's call. I mean, there is a sort of sense of responsibility. We've been there for a long time. What's the path forward? I'll start with you, Johnny.
We have absolutely been there for a long time. I would strongly agree with Hope that as unsatisfying as our presence can be in some ways, in that the war has not been won, it's not about to be won, we are a crucial element of such security as there is in the country. And we should never make the mistake of thinking it can't get worse, because in the complete absence of foreign troops, there's a very real chance of a bloodbath that would really affect us all. In terms of the way forward, mentioned a peace process earlier, that's a difficult proposition in its own right. Many others consider it, let's say, less unlikely than the prospect of winning outright on the battlefield. And you do have all of the key players, the U.S. government, the Afghan government, and the Taliban, at least notionally interested in recent months in exploring whether this kind of diplomatic conversation could avoid the bloodbath that we're all afraid of. Now, that's certainly suffered a setback in the last several days, as all sides have been pretty horrified by what's happened in Kabul and Jalalabad. But the fundamental military realities remain, and I would say the fundamental strategic interest of each party in exploring a diplomatic solution is very much alive.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punterful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about 16 years of war in Afghanistan and the way forward. Last month, CBS's 60 Minutes aired an interview with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. He was blunt about the state of affairs in his country.
21 international terrorist groups are operating in this country. Dozens of suicide bombers are being sent. Their factories are producing suicide bombers. We are under siege.
We're talking with Tom Johnson, an Afghan expert at the Naval Postgraduate School and author of the new book called Taliban Narratives. Also with us, a former advisor on Afghan peace talks at the State Department and now senior expert on Afghanistan at the U.S. Institute of Peace, Johnny Walsh. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Stay the course, hold the line, throw out current plans and come up with something radically different. And let's go to some of our callers. We've got a lot of them standing by. We want to get a lot of folks in on this conversation. So let's go to Robert, who's calling from Freiburg, Maine. Robert, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony. How you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
That's good. I'm a retired major in the United States Army. I did spend some time in Afghanistan. I wanted to weigh in a little bit on the component of narratives. I did some work in the Australian Staff College back in 2009 regarding how narratives connect an effort to the population and what makes you and your story resonate with the people that you're working with, a contested population. And insurgents have a connection almost naturally, and the problem with U.S. forces is that it's difficult for a military element like the United States Army or the Marines or whoever to connect to the population and make them believe that they're a long-term solution. As far as many people on the ground are concerned, we're just a redo of the Russian occupation. And it's just a continuation of many iterations of occupying Afghanistan, albeit to expand an empire to quell terrorism or to defeat terrorist cells. And ultimately, a long-term solution is just never going to manifest itself in a meaningful way that can be defined as success. So that's pretty much my point.
Robert, thanks so much for the work you've done over there, and thanks for calling in. Tom Johnson, Robert was talking about narratives. I'd love to get your response because I know that's something you do a lot of thinking about.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd like to thank Robert for his service, and I agree with his points. Mao Zedong once said that insurgents are like fish swimming in the water. And the metaphor, of course, is that the fish are the insurgents and the water are the people. And in these types of conflict, you have to have a population base supporting you. And the Taliban recognized this all along. And they came up with a number of key narratives and associated stories. Their narratives, their first major narrative relates to jihad and that infidels and apostate Afghans are trying to destroy Islam and the Afghan way of life. And they have a whole series of stories and very unique to send those stories to the rural population. The second major narrative they have is the cultural nuances of Afghanistan, and we have to maintain those. And a lot of this deals with Pashtun Wali, or literally the code of the Pashtun. Now, the Taliban, when they were first formed, were almost exclusively Pashtun. But since 2009, many other ethno-linguistic groups, including Hazaras, Uzbeks, Tajiks, have actually joined the Taliban. The third major narrative deals with political notions, and some of this deals with nationalism. And their stories are very, very, very interesting. The problem that we have, and I experienced this firsthand when I was a senior COIN and political advisor to the Canadian troops in 2009, people just did not would ask me constantly, why are the U.S., why is Canada, why is NATO in the country? And I didn't even have a very good answer then, because they had seen 8 years of war.
But Tom, let me just jump in right there, because before the break, Johnny was making a pretty important point, I think, that I'd like you to respond to in terms of why we're in the country. He suggested that as bad as things are going, the American troops are still providing a crucial element of security. And as bad as things are, without them, there would be a bloodbath if they weren't there.
Well, I think that that's a possibility, and I think that's a strong possibility. But I think that we also have to consider that we've been there going on 17 years. We've spent near $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. We've lost 2,400 men. We've had scores, thousands and thousands of wounded people. And what has it gotten us? The Taliban have said from day one, Mullah Omar said this, his successor Mansour said this, and the present Taliban leader, or one of the factions of the Taliban, Akhundzada, has also suggested that the Taliban will never sincerely negotiate or reconcile until internationals leave the country. So we constantly hear about these peace talks and things like that.
So in other words, we've got it backwards. In other words, you know, there's this idea that we've got to stay engaged and force these folks to the bargaining table. You're saying they're not going to come to the bargaining table unless we leave.
Absolutely, and the data all suggests that that is correct.
All right, I want to make sure we get Johnny in here as well. Johnny, respond to that idea that we're sort of doing it backwards.
First, I wonder if I might respond to the narratives point.
Sure, go ahead.
I think Tom is absolutely right that Americans will always be at a huge disadvantage compared to native Afghans in a battle of messaging, and I would strongly agree that the Taliban have an unusually coherent, consistent message that plays very strongly into deeply held Afghan national beliefs, especially about foreign occupation. However, that narrative is far more effective when it's targeted at a certain constituency of rural Pashtuns. The Pashtuns are one of several, the largest, but one of several ethnic groups in Afghanistan. The narrative is far less resonant with urban anyone or with other ethnic groups across the country. And while it's true that some members of other ethnic groups have joined, this is an overwhelmingly Pashtun movement. Mm-hmm. And the reason that's important is because the Taliban are not popular. They have enough support, I would say, to continue recruiting a large fighting force indefinitely and for years to come. And that's a major military problem. But we shouldn't believe that if the U.S. just left, the Afghan population would rally as a whole to the Taliban, because they're genuinely loathed across large segments of the country. And that itself is why there's such concern about a bloodbath.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
Let me just hold the next point. I know I asked you a question. You were going to get to that. But I want to make sure that I'm leaving room for a bunch of callers, because we've got a lot on the line. Let's go to Randy, who's calling from Huntersville, North Carolina. Randy, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony. I was actually a Central Air Force war planner for Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq 2001-2003. So I dealt with, you know, making a strategy on how to win. And the fact is, we've lost long ago, and we will never win. And I will say this because, you know, frankly, history and precedence is not on our side. When people say we're going to win, I would challenge them. My question to them would be, show me cases or a case in history where some occupying power was able to, in the long run, strategically win. You know, you can compel people through brutality to, you know, adhere to you for a short term, but in the long term, you're never going to win. Afghans are going nowhere. The Taliban are going nowhere. And the fact is, we live a half a world away. Thank you.
Randy, again, thank you for the work that you've done for this country. And thanks for that call. Johnny Walsh and Tom Johnson, I want to talk about another idea, and that is a new way forward. I mean, do we need to be thinking about a big regional diplomatic push instead of war? Johnny Walsh, let me come to you with that question.
I think we absolutely need to be thinking about a diplomatic push. I would say regional outreach, and that's generally understood to mean especially to Pakistan, but also to China, Russia, India, Iran. That's only one component. I would say that this is fundamentally an intra-Afghan conflict. It is and it can only fundamentally be decided by an agreement to make peace between the Afghan insurgency and the Afghan government. Now, there's an element of pressing Pakistan to close down safe havens. The administration has gone quite far in that direction to try and crack down on Pakistan. There is an element of ensuring that China and Russia and the others I mentioned don't perceive a long-term security threat to themselves in whatever outcome happens in Afghanistan. But at root, as is true in most of these internal conflicts, the really hard decisions about how to share power, about what the constitution's going to look like, they have to be made by Afghans, and no one outside the country can fundamentally force an Afghan party into them.
Mm. And Tom Johnson, on this issue, you know, beyond the acknowledgement that the military campaign is lost on the ground or at best a stalemate, what's the big idea? What's your big idea going forward about what we need to do?
Well, I agree with everything that Johnny just said. And I think that the only way out of Afghanistan is a political solution and some type of reconciliation between Kabul and the Taliban. But I again suggest that the Taliban will never sincerely negotiate or consider reconciliation until international forces leave. They've been very true to this point. And this puts us between a rock and a hard place. Mm. On the 60-minute interview that you played a few minutes ago, Ghani also said that if internationals left, that the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces would fall within 6 months. I think that's vastly optimistic. I think that if the international forces left, the Ghani government, if they left at noon, the Ghani government would probably be over by 5 p.m. and the Afghan National Security Forces would probably disappear into the walls a day or two later. So this is the real dilemma. They're not going to negotiate until internationals leave. And if internationals leave, Kabul will probably fall quite quickly. That's a major dilemma. But I still maintain some hope because Afghans are pragmatic people. I've been going to this country for 3 decades. And I think that they can come up with a solution. On the regional side, we haven't really discussed the duplicity of Pakistan, which has really, as Steve Cole's new book is going to suggest, was the number one strategic failure of the last 16 years in Afghanistan. I mean, the major terrorist events, the hideous events that have occurred the last couple of weeks and in fact, the last couple of years in Kabul have mostly been performed by the Haqqani group. And Haqqani is in the Pakistani's intelligence service, ISI's back pocket. So, you know, I'm sorry that we haven't had a chance to talk about the duplicity of Pakistan and the impact.
Well, we've got some time. Let's get into that. And let me shift over to Johnny and ask about that. Sticking with Pakistan, I mean, the Trump administration is withholding more than $1 billion worth of annual aid to Pakistan until it does more to pressure the Taliban. First of all, is that a sensible approach? And to what extent is the key here engaging with Pakistan?
I would say, first of all, that anyone who has served in Afghanistan, very much myself included, has felt just visceral anger at Pakistan for allowing these safe havens to persist from which these insurgent groups kill Americans, kill Afghans in even greater numbers. And there's no question that the Pakistani state turns, at the very least, a blind eye to these groups and has for many years, and that's one of the fundamental pillars the groups rely on to survive. At the same time, I think there's two important questions to ask as we follow a policy of trying really to crack down on Pakistan. Number one is, what reaction does that produce in the Pakistanis? Does the use of ever stronger sticks actually cause them to change behavior? The early indications are not so positive. The Pakistanis have responded with defiance and have generally enjoyed the support of the population in doing so, and have made fairly clear that they are seeking out China as an alternate patron. They've been very close to China for a long time. In other words, that they can live without the U.S. So time will tell. The administration likely has more measures in mind that it will consider in the interest of pressing Pakistan. The second question is, can Pakistan deliver the peace process that we want? And while the Taliban make great use of the safe haven, I would not say that they are deeply dependent on it for their very survival. And I say that for a few reasons. Number one, the Taliban are one of the largest and strongest insurgent groups in the world just based on their presence inside of Afghanistan. You know, some say 70, 80,000 fighters. And as they control more and more in the of the Afghan countryside, they have their own internal safe havens. That's enough to generate the revenue that they need. There are enough weapons inside of Afghanistan to not depend on getting them from the ISI. So all that is to say, no one should morally excuse Pakistan or its intelligence service for the relationship it's carried on. But neither should we think that that itself is the core to pacifying the Taliban insurgency.
All right, Tom, our time grows short, but I want to give you the last word here. You said you wanted more time to talk about Pakistan, so respond to Johnny Walsh any way you want.
Well, I agree with much of what Johnny Walsh has suggested. I think that, again, we're in a rock, between a rock and a hard place. Pakistan, while they've been extremely duplicit, I mean, gee, Mullah Omar died in a Karachi hospital 3 years before they told us. I mean, Osama bin Laden lived within a half a mile of one of their major military academies in Abbottabad. They support terrorist organizations such as LET, JUM, and many others. But one of the things that we have to consider, Pakistan has us around our neck to a certain extent because of the logistics role. Afghanistan is a landlocked country. So we've relied on Pakistan to be able to feed our soldiers. Right now, or in the near future, we'll have 15,000 soldiers and probably 25 to 30,000 contractors. There's no way that we can feed them on a daily basis via the air. So Pakistan complicates the situation there.
Big complications. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. 16 years of war, a stalemate between a rock and a hard place, not a lot of good choices. But I'm very grateful to my guest, Tom Johnson, an Afghan expert at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Thank you, Tom, for participating today. We're very grateful.
My distinct pleasure.
And Johnny Walsh, senior expert on Afghanistan at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Johnny, thank you as well.
Thanks so much, Anthony.
That's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.